Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I ask you, what will it take to heal the Earth, to heal our planet, to heal our civilization? What will it take? Perhaps we need the return of the Divine Sophia. And there's a book called Return of the Divine Sophia, Healing the Earth Through the Lost Wisdom Teachings of Jesus, Isis, and Mary Magdalene. Wow. And this is a great book. I loved reading it. Such amazing research, archaeological research, all kinds of research into the history of our planet and the wisdom teachings of the past. And to help us understand the subject matter is the author of Return of the Divine Sophia and a good friend of mine, Tricia McCannon. Tricia, welcome.
Oh, Peter, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be back with your listeners in New York and the northeastern area.
Great, and we actually have listeners from all over the world.
Yeah, well, I always love coming up to that area. And as you know, I travel and teach and speak everywhere. I've just come back from Boulder, and I'm heading out to San Francisco this week. And at the end of May, I'm going to be coming up to New York City and the Pennsylvania area. So I'll be speaking about this very subject, Return of the Divine Sophia, and how to heal the Earth and the spiritual technologies that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were teaching that were taught within the ancient mystery schools. So it's a pleasure to be back with you today.
Well, it's so wonderful to talk with you because you're always amazing. The information that you have, and the depth of knowledge and the wisdom that goes with it. And you really are a divine person yourself because you are tuned in intuitively in the universe and speak with angelic beings. And but really your book is so grounded in so much research of the history of our planet, understanding what's behind us, why, what are we missing, and why, and where, and how do we know that we're missing it? And you bring to light some things in your book historically that really amaze me, how many thousands of years the divine feminine really ruled, and we had peace. We had thousands of years with no warfare. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's actually quite astounding because most of us just sort of believe in the societies that we've grown up in and what we've been conditioned to believe as being predictable or normal for human history. That history kind of goes back to about 3,000 years. We have the Christian peace that came in 2,000 years ago with Jesus, and then the Muslim, and before that we have the Jewish peace that comes in. So those Judeo-Christian religions, which are at least in theory monotheistic, but yet seem to be very locked up in dualism, are more recent evolutions or devolutions, if such a word is true, from talking about a history that really predates it by around 200,000 years or further back. And, as you know, The Return of the Divine Sophia, this book is my third book, and the first one, as you said, was, very much about the angelic kingdoms and the vast hierarchy of spiritual worlds that come down to support this one. My second book was about the lost teachings of Jesus and where he went during the 30 lost years, and was very full of some 1,200 footnotes and 100 illustrations an extensive bibliography where we were able to chronicle where he moved to. Well, what happened in that particular creation of that book, which took me 3 years, was I wound up having to pull out about 200 pages about his secret teachings. And his secret teachings were about the Divine Mother and the Divine Father, the Abba Amma, and the Divine Daughter and Divine Son, which most of us know nothing about. I mean, in the Judeo-Christian religions, we're talking about God the Father, but what happened to God the Mother? And we know in Christianity, God the Son, but we don't know anything about God the Daughter. And so when I began to, some years ago, into these hidden teachings that were really kept from the public by the patriarchal establishment, Judeo-Christian religions, I began to be astounded by what I found. And as the new book, Return of the Divine Sophia, chronicles, that book really begins with the story when I was about 27 years old of how I became introduced to these inner esoteric mystery schools, including the Egyptian mysteries of the priestesses of Isis and the shamanic mysteries of the Native American twisted hair traditions and the Celtic mysteries, and these mystery schools that had taught a balance between the masculine and the feminine for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Well, as I became, you know, initiated into these paths of wisdom, my logical brain that had been, you know, I'm the daughter of a lawyer, you know, was like, is this possible? Could this be true? So I rolled up my sleeves, of course, and began to actually do the investigative research. And what I found was, at an archaeological level, going back at least 240,000 years, for, you know, thousands of years, God was worshipped as the goddess or the great mother, because everyone could observe that who gave birth were women. And so who would have birthed the universe? Of course, the great mother. And this is why we have the Milky Way, or the mother's milk, that birthed our solar system and the stars and the planets. And, of course, this completely astounded me. And then over time, it became a more balanced expression of the divine masculine and feminine, the divine mother and father, which, you know, makes perfect sense to me. I mean, we can observe everything seems to be the masculine and feminine out there in the world. It's meant to be in balance. And then it evolved to where it was honoring the divine son and the divine daughter. Well, of course, we lost every bit of this. I mean, we wound up with kind of a patriarchal system that's a very hierarchical system, very dominator model. And when we go back in time, we discover that prior to about 4,000 B.C., we don't seem to have evidence for war. The weapons were used for hunting for food, but there was a partnership model in place. The line of succession usually passed through the women's line, not always, but often. The men that ruled were her husband or her brother. They had their power. They had their place. They certainly had respect and meaning and purpose, and so did the women. And then the next ruler would be the daughter of that mother, who then chose the hero or the wonderful man. And I think, you know, this whole model of rulership created what they call matriistic societies of enormous balance that had agriculture, it had textiles, it had all the arts of civilization, but we weren't killing each other. And this, of course, blew my mind, because what we've been taught that history is, and most of us believe, that we just continue to create war, and more war, and that war and killing and competition and strife is the way of the world, and it has never been any different, and it never can be any different. So we just continue to repeat these crazy functional patterns that have been passed down to us for 3,000 or 4,000 years.
Well, something happened. There was something about 4,000 years ago, or even 5,000 years ago, that shifted the energy to be more hierarchical. Some energy shift on this planet in consciousness shifted our awareness to war.
Well, you and I both know that Earth is not isolated. We are in a sea of electromagnetic energies. And just in the same way that we can observe that the moon has an effect on our tides and on our plants and on our gestation cycles and our moods, all the other planets do too. And so this is what, of course, astrology is based on, which is the esoteric arm of astronomy. And in astrology, we go through over a 25,920-year phase, just so our listeners can remember, let's just say 26,000 years roughly. We slowly, the Earth, goes through 12 different, let us say, ages. And these ages are each roughly around 2,160 years. And they seem to very slowly come in and change the consciousness of the societies that are in place. And about 2150 BC, we wound up moving into the age of Aries. And Aries, of course, is an age ruled by Mars, the god of war. It's known as a very aggressive, competitive, male-dominant, fiery age. And if we look back in time, we can see everything from Alexander the Great to the Roman Empire to all those wars between the Persians and the Hittites and the, you know, Assyrians and the Hebrews and the Egyptians. And everyone was just fighting, fighting, and fighting during that whole period of time. And when Jesus appeared, it was kind of the end of the age of Aries and the beginning of the age of Pisces. And Pisces has been what's been in play for the last 2,000 years. And in its highest expression, it's the mystic. It's the one who is a water sign. It's a feminine energy. It's the one who goes within. But if we're not connected in the balance between the male and the female, which we lost, unfortunately, with the dominance of Judaism, Christianity, and the Muslim religion, those religions, what happens is the victimizer, the age of Aries in the Roman Empire, got moved over to the Roman Catholic Church, unfortunately, and it kind of continued that era of oppression through the, you know, the six centuries, really, of the Inquisition. And as I chronicle in my book, the statistics are that some 50 million people were murdered by the church, first as heretics up through the 1200s or 1300s, taking out the, you know, the Abigens, through the Abigensian Crusades and the Cathars and the Knights Templars. And finally, you know, we get into the 1300s to about the mid-1800s, it became the witch hunt. And they, of course, many wonderful men were taken out, but they estimate that some 9 million women were basically tortured and burned at the stake. And women lost, you know, they couldn't hold a job. They had no right to inherit property. They had no right to own property. If the man in the family died, the son or the father or the uncle, then they were thrown out on the street. So it became a very sad time where men were holding all the power. And, of course, there were good men, of course, but there were also abuses in that. As they say, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So we certainly had a fair amount of that.
Right. And then there was the rewriting of history so that people were blinded to what the potential could be.
That's very true. I mean, one of the great rewrites that I would like to point to is that whole crazy story of Adam and Eve. And, you know, the Hebrew culture actually started off pretty great. They had the divine masculine and feminine, mother and father, and the divine daughter and son. And that was what was all honored at the time of King Solomon around 950 B.C., but the priests of Yahweh were very relentless in trying to kind of suppress any other expression other than their own political powers. And so at the time that the Jews were, you know, Samaria was taken down, the northern kingdom, around 722 B.C. by the Assyrians, and then the southern kingdom, Judea, they were taken down around 570. And they were in captivity in Babylon for about 50 years. And when they were released around 518, 520 B.C., only a third of the Jews went back to start over, to rebuild the second temple of Solomon. The others stayed in Babylon. And it was at that point that the Persians, who actually had become very patriarchal themselves, underwrote the building of the roads and the construction of the new temple, and they pretty much said, hey, you know, we want people to pay taxes, and so we're willing to invest this money in your communities, but, you know, get a grip, get in power, get in control. And so about 3% of the population could actually read, and that would have been the priest of Yahweh, and that was the opportunity they needed. And that's when what we know of as the Old Testament started really being codified and written and rewritten. We know about 40 to 60% of it was written from about 100 BC to 500 BC. And the story of the flood, they hadn't had that story before they were in Babylon. That was the Atrahasis. It was the Sumerian version or the Chaldean version, the Babylonian version of the Great Flood. And they hadn't had the story of the Garden of Eden. And the Garden of Eden, the original story was, you know, that the gods, the Elohim, plural, created man and woman together as equals. But the priest of Yahweh, that didn't really kind of serve their political agenda, so they rewrote it that the fiction that man was created first and then woman was taken from his rib, and that's kind of been the justification, along with poor little Eve getting blamed for eating the apple first, for the subjugation of women. Well, come to find out, in actual biology, all mammals are created biologically female first, every single one, and the existence of the male has to do with the release of an additional androgen that allows that extra chromosome to be formed. So in reality, we all begin as female, and the male is a subset of the female. And that's, you know, so that's a huge lie that's kind of been perpetrated for about 2,500 years. And the what's legitimized the subjugation of women, which I found to be just, I was stunned by that. It was like, wait a minute, if this is biologically true, how can we have been lied to theologically for so many centuries?
Well, it's now that it's been such a long time that women have been seen as the lesser of the sexes, there's been a tremendous rewriting of female, of what the female is worth in relationships, in life, in the world, and so women have had to reestablish their value and importance, and in so many ways, the men keep, and still in politics, it's true, men keep looking at women just as objects. And not giving them the sense of power that they, you know, they'll look at a woman and criticize how she looks, what her hair is like, what her clothing is like. Whereas with men, they don't do anything of the sort.
Well, you know, it's very true, Peter. I think that women's worth, because, you know, as I talk about in my book, there's a positive expression of the feminine, a positive expression of the masculine, and those are the places we really want to focus on and develop within each of us, whether we're a man or a woman. There's also a negative expression of the male and a negative expression of the female. And when the negative masculine, the big dominator-oppressor model, winds up taking away the ability for either other men or other women to express themselves in a creative, dynamic, positive, more direct way, what happens, you know, if women, I mean, as I relate in my book, you know, at the time of when Jesus came around, women, if women were raped, they either had to marry their rapist or they were stoned to death. Now, the man didn't get punished at all, okay, and he was really the perpetrator. So, you know, women lost all ability to speak their truth. All a man had to do was give a woman a slip of paper and say, we're divorced, I'm done with you, get the hell out. Where a woman had no right to divorce her husband, no matter how he abused her or used her. And this is one of the reasons that even today, you know, they say, what, there are three women killed every single day in America by husbands or boyfriends, and that the rate is something like 50% of all homicides against women are by their husbands or their boyfriends, and many, many times there's lots of cases of physical abuse before the murder even happens. And, you know, we look over in the Muslim world, and it's a million times worse, where women are just, you know, shot in the face for wanting to get an education, or 300 schoolgirls are raped and abducted and sold into sexual slavery, and no one even, you know, protests. I was reading recently in November that these terrorists came in and literally drove all the men, those would have been the positive men, out of the village, raped all the women and children because they suspected that they knew the location of one of their people, and then wouldn't even let them get any help in the hospitals. Can you imagine the generations of trauma that produced? Only to then later come back and say, oops, sorry, we found the guy in another village, you know? And it's like, are you kidding me? I mean, the trauma for the good men who could not protect those they loved, the trauma for the good women who suddenly, you know, had to be have violence done to them at level, the problem for the children. I mean, we're talking, you know, just continuing this legacy of anger and fury and impotence. So what happens is then, you know, once we finally do rise up against that, it's not in a balanced state. It's a very reactive state, of course. And this is one thing we were talking about yesterday on the telephone in preparation for this show, that the, as women first began to kind of, you know, they got the right to vote in 1922 here in America, and then finally in World War II, there was such a depletion of the wonderful men in our country, women finally got to go to work on the assembly lines because they were desperately needed. And so that sort of began the opening where women were kind of, it was okay to have a job and so forth. And as the feminist movement came in, initially a lot of women were just so angry that they actually were being, you know, very reactive to even the most wonderful men that were trying to hold open doors for them because they just had had generations of feeling like a victim. So they, in fact, became, you know, angry victimizers. And so as they've come back into some kind of balance, still the way that women go about expressing power, their only model for power has been the male model, and that's a dominator model. And consequently, many a good woman in her effort to be competitive and get to the top and be successful winds up becoming as ruthless and oppressive and argumentative and difficult as any of the men, because that's the model that she has. When in truth, the way that women carry power should be completely different. The model for the feminine model, it's a cooperative model, not a competitive model. It's a model that says everybody here has value, everybody has something important to bring to the table, and we can work together. If the male model's hierarchical model is circular.
Well, we're doing our best to change the world, and yet it looks like a very, very hard mountain to climb. So where are we going to find the opportunities to get where we want things to go?
Well, I think the opportunities are everywhere, and it's not just in the human world. For example, in the feminine model, and I say feminine model knowing that many an enlightened man has embraced this model, it's like the Native American medicine wheel that says, look, we're all in this circle together. We've got the animals, we've got the trees and the plants, we've got the minerals, and we've got the humans. And if we're going to survive, every species must survive and thrive. So when we start saying, how can we make a difference? Well, at the simplest level right there, we have to find the balance of honoring the animals, the people, the land itself, not just raping and pillaging and fracking and corrupting the water and building nuclear power plants so that if we have an earthquake, we wind up with what we have in Fukushima, which is, you know, terrible radiation. And, of course, every country that has nuclear power plants. I mean, the poles are melting. For heaven's sakes, it doesn't take a genius to figure this out. You know?
Well, it's true that the fight is on. And because of the Internet, everything is more and more transparent. And so we're calling the lie where it is. And it's really powerful to be able to see how poorly this world is being run and how much has to be changed. And yet the powers that be seem to be fairly stuck, and it's hard to move that, and we can be hopeful that we keep on gnawing away at it, chipping away at it, and we'll make a lot of progress. I also like the way your book ended, because it was the greatest sign of hope. And I really enjoyed understanding the opportunity that we all have to wake up, in not just in the mind, not just through the internet and hearing more about right and wrong, but something more internal is happening. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I would say that there are a lot of people like yourself who are really about claiming that balance and walking as what I would call a Christed being on the planet. And many of our listeners may be, in fact, those very people. This is actually something that Jesus and Mary Magdalene, who, of course, was turned into the prostitute slut by the patriarchal, you know, societies around, you know, the 500, I think it was 591 A.D., where Pope Gregory the First announced his homily 33, where he you know, speculated that the expensive spikenard that had been used to anoint Jesus, and of course that's what Christed means, is the anointed, and that was a rite that was given only to the highest level priest kings throughout ancient times, marking Jesus as one of those Horus kings, and marking Mary Magdalene actually as a high priestess of Isis, and I talk about this in the book. They went on to teach in the first 100 years after the crucifixion something called the Way of the Chalice, and it's a spiritual technology of enlightenment that honors and develops the masculine, the positive masculine, and the positive feminine in union, grounding it into the world, and also, like a chalice, opening ourselves up to become the receivers of that pure spiritual light and to bring that balance back down to the earth. And, you know, we have to work on ourselves first, but certainly we are living in a world where all the action that we can take, whether it's how we teach our children at home to cooperate instead of simply suppress others, to listen as well as to speak, to begin to change the paradigms from within, and the family structure, in the business structure, and the corporate structure. All of this is, you know, in the structure in terms of the environment that we're living in, so that we're not desecrating our planet and thinking that we flee to Mars in order to, you know, terraform Mars, which is the craziest thing I've ever heard when you consider that we're living on a paradise planet that we seem to be polluting. So there are, on a daily level, we can begin to work on our own inner balance, open up our intuition, open up the right side of our brain, which is the feminine, faith-based, positive side, where we speak not to the negative. Oh, this is killing me. Oh, this is so hard. I'm so sick. Things are so terrible. No, we speak into the positive, and we live out of that place of the positive. And the masculine side, the left side of the brain, is the practical side. It's the realistic side. It's the protective side. And they both serve a purpose. They should not be operating alone, or we wind up with a world out of balance.
So let's now, I mean, this is wonderful. This is so great talking with you. So let's help our listeners find out how to learn more by finding your book on the web or finding you through the web. What's the best way to do that?
Well, they can go to my website, which is TriciaMcCannonSpeaks.com, and that's TriciaMc, Mac, Cannon, just like it sounds, CannonSpeaks, Speaks, SPEAKS.com. So you'll get to see, you know, many things. I have about 30 DVDs and CDs. I have 13 online classes for my mystery school, as well as all three of my books, The Dialogues of the Angels, Return of the Divine Sophia and Lost Years of Jesus books.
Tricia McCannon, thank you so much. This is so great talking with you, and really happy you could be a guest on Energy Stew.
Peter, thank you so much for having me. I look forward to the next time.
Thank you. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heart river.org, or 212-222-7748. Thank you so much for listening.